Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Sports Community Radio here on 3RPPFM, the voice of the peninsula. My name is Joe Novella, and along with my co-host, Steve Pallas, over the next hour, we will be talking grassroots sport and inviting you to join us in our conversations because your voice and experiences in the field of grassroots sports are important to us. So feel free to contact us on our social media pages. You can find us on both Twitter and Facebook by searching for Sports Community, or just visit our website at www.sportscommunity.com.au and drop us an email at jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au if you want to provide your opinion or feedback on any of the topics that we discussed today. We would greatly appreciate it, and we'll make a point of airing your views on the show. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce my co-host, Steve Pallas.
Morning, Joe. How are we going?
I'm going very well. How are you going?
Well, it's bright and early on a Saturday morning. Going well. Thank you very much.
And Steve, what I would like to do is I'd like to introduce the listeners to what the sports community is all about. Now, you founded the company, and you also are a director of the company. And just wondering if you could walk us through how the concept came about, what the motivations are. I mean, was it something that you'd had a lot of wine one night and decided you were going to go ahead with, or is it something that you feel is needed in the community?
Yeah, thanks, Joe. Sports Community really is an organisation, and this is a show for helping grassroots clubs and their volunteers succeed, really. The concept really, really started probably 25 years ago when I was a 20-year-old, or just a little bit older than that, secretary of the Mount Martha Cricket Club, who many of our listeners will know of. I was at uni at the time, had no idea how to be a secretary or a sports club administrator, had a young committee. So I did what all university students do, and well, some university students do, Joe, not all of us, but I went to the library, and this may or may not have been before the internet, Joe, and looked up, you know, how to run a local sports club, and there really, really wasn't any resources. So I went back to Mount Martha and did what 20-year-old blokes do, and spent most of my time in the club rooms and socialising and not a lot of administration, and ended up being, I would suggest, the world's worst sports club administrator, which in our travels I'm yet to meet a worse one than that. And for 20 years that annoyed the living daylights out of me, that I was such a poor administrator. And professionally I went in and worked in financial services for 20 odd years, and then 2007-2008 I was lucky enough to have the honour of being the CEO of the Mornington Peninsula and Nepean Football League, which at the time and still is 32 senior football clubs and 12 netball clubs. And it was a great role, and I got to work with a lot of the clubs closely, and I realised then that the clubs were having the same issues that I'd had kind of 20 years previously. So I thought, oh well, the internet's been around for you know, most of that time, and there's lots and lots of information. So I started to research to find some resources for the volunteers, and still there really wasn't anything to help that volunteer, that you know, the mum and dad or the person who just says, yeah, I'll stick my hand up and do the job. And so, long story short, and yeah, there was a fair bit of red wine involved in the final stage of the decision making. Yeah, a group of us got together and said, yeah, rightio, we'll build that resource for grassroots clubs and grassroots volunteers and their clubs. So the sports community website started in January 2012, and since then we've been all over the country training sports clubs and hearing the wonderful stories. So I guess it's those stories that we hope to bring on the show, really.
So we what we're trying to do with the Sports Community Radio Show is there's a lot of people out there that would be involved in grassroots sports clubs as administrators, volunteers, in whatever capacity. And so we're trying to provide a resource to these people to allow them to do the best possible job that they can do at their local club.
Yeah, making it easier, saving time, easier. Not stressful. Make it enjoyable. Like, people join the committee for many, many reasons, but Often they leave because they just didn't have the information or the knowledge to make it easy.
So the radio show is really an extension of the website that that has been set up already by Sports Community, in that the radio show is going to be here to help all club administrators and club volunteers to do their job better. And that's why we're inviting everyone to email us if they have any topics that they'd like to raise or get involved with the show at jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au, or visit our website and contact us that way. Now, tell me, Steve, what are some of the ways, or what are some of the bits of information, critical bits of information that you have on the website and that we will plan to talk about with the radio show?
Yeah, it's a huge challenge for club administrators, the amount of information that they really need to know. So we've got a lot of information. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I guess from the radio show's point of view, Joe, for every topic, what we'll do is we'll bring an expert in and talk to our listeners about that particular topic, and whether that expert's from the local clubs, or whether it's from a local club that's doing a fantastic job, or whether it's from a state national body, or whether it's from government or wherever. We'll bring the people with that information to them. But yeah, I mean, your expertise in social media and communications, we get inundated with information or requests for information about grants and fundraising.
So it's really those kind of key topics that we've isolated out there in the community are of the most concern to sports clubs. It's fundraising, accessing grants, and also resources on things like club governance, because as boring and tragic as it sounds, club governance, a lot of people don't know, a lot of clubs don't know, volunteers don't know how to run an AGM, for example, yeah, or what their legal liabilities are. So we're here to help them in that respect as well, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely. And it's the club governance or club behaviour or culture.
Culture, yes.
They're all the things that no one tells you about when you join the committee. You know, that's almost like the fine print of joining the committee, and particularly if you're not used to managing people or leading people, all of a sudden you're in charge of the behaviour of your whole club, or running a meeting, or achieving setting the strategic plans and objectives and what you're going to do, and deciding what sort of club that you want to be. Do you want to be a club that just focuses on participation, or do you want to be a club that focuses on you know, winning premierships and medals and medallions, and both of that's fine, but that's, for some people, that's a challenging sort of situation to have to work themselves through. So
when you go out and you talk to a lot of clubs, which you do need to do in your capacity as the managing director of sportscommunity.com.au, what are the themes that come through time and time again? What are the clubs and the volunteers out there asking for the most?
Yeah, it depends on how long the person's been involved in running the club. I mean, they start with wanting to help the sport and getting involved in the sport and the match day competitions, whether it be, you know, a swimming club or a bowls club or whatever. But over a period of time, they move away from that and get more stuck, if you like, in the mechanics of running the club. So making sure there's enough money, making sure that you do that corporate governance, liaising with councils, liaising with governments, liaising with the community, which can be tremendously daunting for some people. So it starts off about how can we develop our sport and our players and our participation, our coaches, but it ends up being, geez, just how do we make enough money to run our club and get it ready for next year? And kind of we talk to clubs and about all of those sorts of things, which is really exciting from a radio show point of view, Joe, because we get to, and this is why we wanted to do the radio show, was because we get to talk to so many amazing people that the show is going to be an amazing platform for some of the stories, and without kind of leading to our first guest. Our first guest is a pretty characteristic of the sort of person that will come onto the show with fantastic stories, fantastic experience, and, you know, and so much to give to local clubs and their volunteers.
You're with Joe Novella and Steve Pallas here on sportscommunityradio.com, sportscommunity.com.au, a radio show for clubs, club volunteers and club administrators. a radio show where all those people will be able to come, will be able to listen to us and get some ideas on how to run their clubs. Apart from the financial challenges clubs face, Steve, one of the other things that I know comes through to me is the topic of running events. And that's something that we cover and have a lot of literature on as well. That's one of the major areas, you know, how to run a fundraiser, how to run a gala events day, those kind of things.
Yeah, exactly right. And so much so that we're going to devote almost the whole show next week to going behind the scenes of a major event. Many of our listeners would know that a local cricket stalwart, David Sands, has come across a period of bad luck, you know, with meningitis and a number of strokes while he was in a coma. So a lot of people involved in David's life have formed a fundraising committee, and they've called that David Sands Road to Recovery Committee. And they're putting on a number of events in February, which are a big auction night and then a celebrity 2020 game. So next week's show, Joe, we're going to go behind the scenes to that. We'll learn a little bit more about David Sands and the challenges he's faced and the amazing story. But also, we're going to go behind the scenes about how to put on an event and all the different things that you need to think about, not just the talent, but money management, marketing, getting people to the event, getting your facilities right, cash management at the event, waste management, volunteers management, all those sorts of things. We'll have a look at. We'll use the David Sands Road to Recovery event as the example, and we'll go behind the scenes, because that is an area where lots of people talk to us a lot about.
What one of the things you just touched on before is volunteers, and that's another area that we will cover in the future on the radio show: how to attract volunteers, how to maintain them, how to reward them, because that is another one of those themes that comes through time and time again for us. Mm. Is that right, Steve?
Oh yeah, and for those that know me, I'm only a short bloke, but I'm going to stand on my soapbox anyway. Volunteer management is our passion, if you like, and treating the volunteers with respect. And when we go around the country, Joe, and we're doing our sports community training, we ask clubs, you know, what do you do to recognise and reward volunteers? And they say, oh, we do this at presentation night, or we have this award at presentation night. And well, you're recognising volunteers once a year. I mean, we should be recognising volunteers in the same way that we recognise players and their performance, coaches and their performance, and umpires and officials. Like, we need to put volunteering within sport up on the same pedestal as the players, coaches and referees. If we're going to thrive as a local sporting organisations, Joe. But I'll just hop off my little soapbox now, because so that's what we talk about.
No, it's good to be on your soapbox, mate. Now, the other thing that you've spoken about there is training, and this is for the listeners out there, I joined Sports Community a little over a year ago, and I've come on to help Sports Community with their marketing, their communications, their social media, and in turn help local sports clubs market and communicate better with potential stakeholders. And one of the striking deficiencies in the local grassroots sports market, for lack of a better word, I should say, is the lack of formal training for volunteers, club committee people, club volunteers. There's just nothing out there, is there, mate? There was nothing out there. So you've spoken about training. Tell me a little bit more about this training, because it is actual classroom formalised training that Sports Community runs, which is now being adopted by the Northern Territory government, which is an outstanding achievement. So just run me through that, because that's quite an important service that Sports Community does provide.
It started off being a service. Look, and the reality was, again, a bit of history about Sports Community, the business. We launched our website on January the 12th, 2012, and January the 13th, 2012, so the day after. So we might have been a little bit misty in celebrating the night before. The phone started ringing from different organisations. In particular, the first one we got was ACT Government, Sport and Recreation in ACT, saying, do you do training? And because the website was quite a significant piece of work when we put it up there. And, of course, we said yes, and we've developed Again, 18 hours, or no, it's more, close enough to 35 hours of different training sessions now, which we are lucky enough to be able to take them all around the country, and with different governments and councils and sports sponsoring us. But they went from being a service to the clubs to really where that's almost where we do our research, Joe. We get to sit down every session. There's normally 30 or 40 different volunteers in the room, and people just tell us, talk to us, and they tell us what they're doing, what they do well as a club, and what they need a bit of help on. And effectively for us, it's just an amazing learning experience.
What really struck me was that there was during some of those courses, there were some people who didn't realise that they were legally on the hook for some of the things that happened at their sports clubs.
Mm.
Now, I'd imagine that there's a hell of a lot of people out there right now listening that wouldn't be aware of that as well. So you can be on the hook for what happens at your sports club.
You can be in certain circumstances. And look, we'll devote a whole show in the coming weeks, not too far away, into some of the responsibilities that volunteers have on the board, and we'll get some of our learned legal gentlemen to join us for that show, just to talk us through that. But we'll also talk about in that show, we'll also talk about the ways that you can minimise risk and in simplistic terms, almost eliminate any personal liability through insurances and those sorts of things. But yeah, you're 100% right. The people go onto the committees with the most fantastic intentions in the world, and don't necessarily realise that some of the obligations that come with that role. And that's really a really powerful thing that we do. I mean, powerful for us, because we get to talk to people about their responsibilities, and then teach them, if you like, about how to minimise those responsibilities. So we'll do that in the next in coming shows as well.
I want to just, if we can, just extrapolate a little bit further on that, in that clubs are no longer just this simplified organisational structure that may have been around 20, 25 years ago. No disrespect to the people who were running clubs 25 years ago. They've done a fantastic job, because most of those clubs are still with us. But nowadays, clubs, you know, it's not just a board of or a committee of six people and 20 volunteers and you know, 150 members. You've got clubs now that have 600, some of the soccer clubs, Mornington Soccer Club, for example, will probably have more than 400 or 500 kids playing at their at their grounds.
Mm.
And you've got committees that are organised in the same lines as businesses are, with CEOs and with people who carry out accounting functions, legal functions, marketing functions. Some of these might even be paid in clubs these days. We've also got clubs that have a bar. So we're talking a whole gamut of legislative obligations there, because, you know, as soon as you serve alcohol, there's a whole bunch of legal
licensing obligations. Yeah,
responsible serving of alcohol.
Yeah,
even the humble sausage sizzle can cause a few problems. I'm just wondering, I know you've talked to me, you've given me this anecdotal story before about the humble sausage sizzle, and one of the fundraisers that we love, one that's very, very successful and traditionally used by a lot of clubs, but on occasions can cause a bit of trouble when not organised properly. I just wonder if you can recount that story, because it's a great story. It's about a Gold Coast club, life-saving club, I believe, that ran a sausage sizzle.
Yeah, I mean, you talked before about how clubs have grown and how their management's changed, but one of the challenges for clubs is often that they haven't evolved and got a little bit more structure and a lot more volunteers. And I guess the stories, the horror stories come out of the clubs that haven't evolved to meet the responsibilities that they have today. And one was a guy, we won't use names, Joe, but it was well publicised, certainly in the Gold Coast press, that there's two surf life-saving clubs, one surf life-saving club, a family had been doing the sausage sizzle for a long time, and another or part of the members accused them of not allocating the funds appropriately within the club, or maybe dishonestly was the allegation. Now, incredibly difficult to prove one way or another without really good processes and good systems, but very easy to destroy a club, and that's nearly what that the humble sausage sizzle and the money that related to.
So we're talking about someone pocketing the loose change,
allegedly.
Yeah,
allegedly, one way or another, and it couldn't prove that. So they're the challenges that we try and
the other interesting ones that really raised my eyebrows when I first joined, and I wasn't aware of the legal obligations that surround them are things like raffles.
Yeah, just about everything that clubs do these days is surrounded by legislation obligation, and that's probably the single biggest difference between now and the clubs you were talking about 20 years ago, where really all they had to focus on was putting the players on the park, on the court, in the pool, in the arena, whatever the sport was. Whereas today, the administrator has got to look after occupational health and safety, gaming and licensing, liquor licensing, incorporated associations. There could be employment law. They've got to look after. They've got to look after codes of conduct of the crowds and the players and the coaches and the spectators and the members. And then there's that whole new world that clubs don't understand, Joe, which is your specialty, which is social media. And it's one of the most incredibly powerful and exciting things to happen to local clubs, but scares the daylights out of them.
And that's where we can help a lot. And that's part of the reason why you set up the business, because we can help in these areas. And we get a lot of clubs coming to us and saying that, well, we weren't aware of this. You know, we had no idea that running a cow lotto in the back of someone's paddock had all these insurance obligations and other legal obligations, and we need your help to walk us through the minefield. Mm. And that's what we do. And not only that, one of the other things that we'll do over the coming weeks, which will help a lot of the folks out there involved in local sports clubs, is that we do have access to a wide list of suppliers. Now, one of the other things that's changed or evolved in the local grassroots community is the need to engage with third-party contractors. So when you're running an event, you know, most clubs nowadays, they want to have coffee vendors, and they want to, you know, they want to put on the best show possible to attract as many people as they can, and that means third-party vendors. And we do have an extensive list of third-party vendors that we can recommend for the listeners out there. There's no commercial arrangements. It's just to enable clubs out there to make better decisions when they need to work out where they have to go to get insurance and these kind of things.
Yeah, that's right. But just going back to your Cow Lotto, which for those of you that don't know about Cow Lotto, it is a fantastic fundraising idea. Mark a square in an oval, and then break that up into lots of little squares. So you might have 100 little squares, sell the squares, and then roll out a cow, and wherever the cow poops, it, whichever square it poops on, that's the one that gets the major prize. But I got an email during the week, Joe, from Northern Territory, where it made the Northern Territory Times newspaper that they had a different version of Cow Lotto. It was Water Buffalo Lotto. So same sort of thing. Fantastic fundraising competition, but fundraising event. Who would have thought it would have been interesting to sit there and watch a water buffalo poop in the paddock? But
who would have thought? You're with a very special guest with us today. His name is Paul Winslow, the marketing, IT, and publications manager at Bowls Victoria, and also the communications manager of the Barmy Army. Welcome to the show, Paul.
Hi, good to be on.
And how you going there today?
Another day in Bowls world. Looking forward to the 2020 on later on in the week. But also looking forward to that cricket tour being over, to be honest.
Now, Paul, just it's Steve Pallas here. Just correct you a little bit. Before you joined Bowls Victoria, you were the communications manager for the Barmy Army for 3 years.
That's right, yeah, so 2 to 3 years. So, yeah, I was responsible for editing their magazine and their website and doing a bit of PR and a bit of marketing and writing a few songs over a beer or two as well.
That's why I purposely ignored that. As soon as I saw the Barmy Army, that's what threw me, Steve.
Okay. And interestingly enough, Paul, just going through your resume for the listeners, that prior to the Barmy Army, you worked at Tottenham Hotspur Football Club. Just give us a little bit of background on that role.
Yeah, we pitched to do Tottenham's official magazine as well, so we managed to win that contract. So for a year, I did Tottenham's official magazine as well. So it works across a few sports now.
Yes, a few sports, a few countries your travels have taken you. Now, we will end up back in the concept of grassroots sport, but I just want to dwell a little bit on your time in the Barmy Army, because you've not only lived it, but you've probably broke a code or two by writing about it as well, when you've got a best-selling novel called Going Barmy, Dispatches from a Cricketing Foot Soldier. So, Paul, what is the Barmy Army? It just looks to me to be a lot of blokes that sing and dance and carry on and make a lot of noise when England are getting flogged.
That is one thing that we are. I mean, it's very, very difficult. The hardest chapter I had to write when I was writing Going Barmy was the one about what is the Barmy Army, because it's different on any given day. So you've got, you know, a core of people who write most of the songs and make most of the noise and, you know, travel to most series. Then you've got the business of the Barmy Army itself as well, because it is a business. But then, you know, the Barmy Army is also on any given day, any people that have, you know, sat in that group of people who are willing to make a bit of noise at a cricket match. So it's very difficult to define exactly what it is. And the problem with that is you obviously get defined by the media. It now sort of has become a catch-all title for any English cricket fan, which is a shame for the England cricket fans who don't want to be a part of us, and shame for us, because there are probably some people who we don't want to be part of the Barmy Army. So it's quite an interesting concept to try and get your head around.
Yeah, and I will ask you at some stage whether the Barmy Army, I mean, of course you think it is, but if it's good for cricket or not. But you touched on the business of the Barmy Army. And this is almost like a local sports club in one regard, that, yeah, it puts on a sporting competition and teams and that sort of thing, but at the end of the day, it now needs to start to act like a business. So from the Barmy Army's perspective, from the business perspective, what is it?
I mean, it started off with two or three blokes who basically printed a load of T-shirts and put the Barmy Army on it, sold those T-shirts, and hey-ho, they realised they'd paid for their tour. So they went home, trademarked it. So it's still very much in the business of merchandise, and that's why you see so many people wearing Barmy Army T-shirts. There is also now Barmy Army Travel. In the past, they've been into various different areas trying to make money, including two or three attempts at recording hit records. That didn't do quite so well. It's not a huge business by any stretch of the imagination, but it's interesting you draw those comparisons with sort of local sports clubs, because it does basically boil down to participation, membership, governance to a certain extent. Not the same as the governance of a club, but trying to sort of get people to behave in a certain way, and also remaining financially viable. So it was quite interesting sort of having gone from that world into the bowls world, just to see those similarities that you don't think would necessarily be there from a sports group to a bowls club.
Yeah, and it's interesting reading the book that the Barmy Army does have a membership structure now, whereas it didn't at the start. Is that still the case?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting sort of anomaly, really, because when I first joined, anybody could be a member of the Barmy Army, and it was just an email database that people would go on and get emails. It then became obvious that actually running the Barmy Army, you know, was costing money. We became an information resource. We had a website, we had magazines, etc. And that had to be financed in some way, in the same way that clubs get their finance by membership fees. But the interesting part of that is, so now you can become a member and you get priority access to tickets. But at the same time, many of the hardcore Barmy Army are not actually official members, because, you know, ultimately turning up and singing songs, being part of it, you don't actually have to be a card-carrying member. But they do have, I mean, last I knew, I think they had about 3,000 members who actually did pay to be a card-carrying member. And like I say, those guys get priority access to events.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, that's an interesting question, because I know standing in the stands at various cricket grounds with the Barmy Army in prime position, How do you get access to all those tickets?
Wheeling, dealing. It's quite interesting. In Australia, you can only be in the Barmy Army section if you book a ticket with Barmy Army Travel. So those of us who don't and travel independently, you know, we just try and find tickets as close to that section as possible. And you know, then what we effectively do is sort of grow that section by trying to get tickets to as near as possible. Australia is only, you know, the hardest place for us to do that. I mean, New Zealand, there's a lot of grass banks, so you can congregate anywhere. And so many of the other countries we go to, realistically, there's more English fans than there are, you know, home fans. So it's quite easy for us to actually congregate and find places to actually sit together.
Yeah. Yeah, and then that leads us on. You've just mentioned a couple of places around the world. So your own personal journey with the Army, take us through that, because you spent a lot of time on the road watching a lot of cricket, probably with not a lot to come back to in the UK at one stage.
Yeah, there were certainly a couple of lost years there where I didn't actually have a home so much as sort of just went off travelling and watching cricket and crashed on sofas. And I had a wonderful time. It was absolutely fantastic. I boiled my possessions down to a carload and sort of dedicated my life to just sort of watching cricket and having a good time and helping out the Barmy Army. So, yeah, I've been lucky enough to do the Caribbean. I've been to New Zealand twice, been to Sri Lanka twice, India twice, South Africa twice, and Australia more times than I can even remember. It's a pretty tough lifestyle to actually keep going. So, like I say, the only way for it to work for me for a while was to effectively become homeless.
Yeah, yes, reading the story, a homeless and partner changing partners quite regularly from what I could tell. But you mentioned the West Indies before, and you seem to have had a good time in the West Indies. And I think any cricket supporter anywhere aspires to eventually at some stage do a Caribbean tour. What's it really like?
It's quite an interesting tour to do, because I mean, it's obviously one tour that's actually several different countries rather than just travelling one. So it's quite expensive, because just getting around the different countries is difficult. And it's also changed considerably, I think, because since they had the World Cup there and they renovated all their grounds are sort of more modern, but probably a bit more soulless. And so it's, you know, it's a beautiful tour and it's got a magic to it. But then, you know, some of the places you go to are actually quite dangerous. But you've got, you know, Antigua with its 365 beaches. Barbados is hugely popular. So yeah, it's like I say, it's got that sort of magic all of it, and you know, the West Indies to cricket they've got a certain sort of magic that no other country really has.
Yeah, and being in the Army or on the tours with the Army, does it actually get you closer to the cricketers, or just get you closer to the excitement in the crowd?
No, it actually does. It really does get you closer to the cricketers. I mean, you know, Graham Swan did the foreword to my book, and that was merely, you know, mainly because I'd met him a few times. You know, I'd written his main song, so I had his email address and managed to get hold of him and said, "Would you mind doing it?" And he was like, "Absolutely, I'd be delighted." But the, you know, the current generation, especially of England cricket players, love the Barmy Army. They're really, really passionate about the Barmy Army, about what we do and what we bring to them. So they always make an effort at the end of a tour, if not the end of a test match, to come and find us and hang out with us. It happened even at the end of the Ashes that's just finished. We had our end of season tour, and sort of five or six of the England players turned up to sort of say thanks, and on this occasion sadly apologised to us for not performing well enough. But yeah, I've been lucky enough to meet a few of the players over the years, and certainly a lot of my friends have as well. So there is a real bond between the team and the fans.
What about the opposition players? I saw that over the last couple of Ashes series that there seemed to be an affinity between the Army and Mitchell Johnson, for instance. How do you go with the opposition players? Is there any personal involvement there, or any involvement with the Army? Is it more at the distance?
It tends to be at a distance. I'm not sure affinity is quite the word I would use with Mitchell Johnson, but there was certainly a relationship, and I don't think, because I think a lot of my friends have sort of bumped into opposition players and certainly had a chat with them, and you know, and that's all we're about. We're all cricket fans, so we're not just England fans, so we're as intrigued to talk to sort of Mitchell as we would be, you know, to talk to Ali Cook in some ways, probably more so, because it'd be quite interesting to find out what it's like to be on the other end. So I mean, obviously, in the same way that
I've just described the England team hanging around with the England fans. Obviously, the Australian team probably wouldn't be quite so keen to go and share that with us. But certainly, I know there is interaction between the Barmy. I mean, you only have to look at quotes from the Australian cricketers as well, that they have a real respect for what we bring to the game.
Now, absolutely. And I think part of that respect is driven by, and it's going to sound like a strange comment, but having witnessed it firsthand, the behaviour of the Barmy Army in one regard, because from my experience, and I've spent quite a lot of time at various cricket grounds around the country, standing with and next to the Barmy Army, it's actually a very respectful group, which doesn't necessarily, that's not how it's always portrayed in the media, but you also work as a group very hard on those behaviours. And how do you actually do that? As you mentioned before, some people are members, some people aren't, some people just join the area. Like, how do you keep that?
It's very difficult, actually. I mean, Australia is the hardest place to do that because there are so many English expats who will sort of join in and sort of go to their local sort of ground and think, oh, yeah, the Barmy Army are here, and get involved and think that it's maybe the same as football, where it isn't. So, and we have to be very careful. You know, you can't really dictate what people do. You know, the majority of us have a similar moral code, and you know, we know about, you know, if you look at English football crowds, they can be very abusive, well, to their own players as well as to opposition players, and that's not, you know, really what we're about. In terms of, you know, you talk about Mitchell Johnson, yeah, we've certainly taken the mickey out of Mitchell, but it's never been abusive about him. But yeah, you just have to try and sort of keep that, you know, and hope that the majority sort of overcome any minority. But ultimately, you know, if you get, you know, 200 people get there and want to sing a song that we don't necessarily agree with, you can't actually stop them doing it. So it's a very, very difficult sort of line that we tread trying to sort that out.
Same as grassroots clubs with their own club behaviour.
Absolutely.
Now, you've travelled the world with cricket, and is it because Melbourne's the sporting capital of the world that you decided to call lay down stumps for a little while, or why Melbourne? And why bowls?
I've heard a lot of people say Melbourne's the sporting capital of the world, and I disagree with them. But I basically ended up here at the end of the last Ashes series. I've been a regular visitor to Australia, so I hung around here to hang out with some friends and met a young Australian lady, and the rest is pretty much history. So I sort of ended up, she's from Melbourne, lived in Melbourne, so I ended up living here. And then when it came to trying to find a way of earning a living, the job in bowls sort of popped its head up. So it was an interesting concept. It wasn't really where I necessarily see myself going, but ultimately, you know, I've worked across different businesses as well as sport, and you know, the challenges that you face from a communications point of view and participation point of view don't change that much, whether you're trying to get somebody to buy a certain model of car or whether you're trying to get people to play a certain sport. So the sort of skill set that I have sort of fitted quite well. And yeah, so I've just celebrated 2 years in bowls. This celebrated is the right word.
Yeah, I can imagine. Now, we might get you back on another show for you to come and explain to us why London is the sporting capital of the world. But Joe, you had a couple of questions.
I did. I have one, Paul. Just really interested in your comments on the culture that's established in the Barmy Army. And given we have a lot of young sports, or young, not so much young sports, but the A-League, for example, that's young in terms of its the time it's been around, 10 years, and it's having a few problems with the kind of fans that it's attracting. I just wonder, how do you propagate that culture or that sense of fair play and those kind of, that kind of moral code that the Army stands for amongst the newcomers to the group?
I think with newcomers to the group, it's actually quite easy if we're on a smaller tour. I mean, it's almost a coincidence. I mean, if you look at all the people in the Barmy Army, they're all nearly all football fans as well. But what we all love about the Barmy Army is it's, you know, like I say, not that abusive element. But it's good that when you get new people involved, that, you know, you can just sort of talk to them and they kind of pick it up, you know, fairly simply. You know, and if you just sort of pick them up on something, they'll sort of go, all right, I get that. I'd say the difficulty comes when you've got huge sort of mobs of people involved. But it's just something that's evolved over time, I think, to be honest. And sort of more and more people buy into that, then it evolves even further.
So,
do you have any communication strategies, like from a technical point of view? Do you use email, or does the Army use social media or any of those tools to kind of embed that culture or what's expected of people, or is it all just word of mouth as people roll up to the events?
It's very much word of mouth to start with, and that is the sort of easiest way to do it in some ways, because it's actually while you're at the event. So, you know, the individual instances that happen during a game you can sort of react to. But I do use Twitter, use Facebook. When the membership first kicked in, we created 6 rules that are sort of the rules that the Barmy Army lives and breathes by. They were called Hoggy's rules because Matthew Hoggard was our patron when we first started the membership. So it is sort of codified, if you like, in terms of, right, this is how the Barmy Army as an organisation wants cricket fans to behave. And because that is on the website, and also you can sort of just sort of nudge that on Twitter and Facebook by making odd comments, then again, everybody knows the sort of issues and problems you can have with social media, because if people disagree with you on social media, then obviously their voice gets heard as well. But it's certainly something they do use, but ultimately it's easier when you're actually at a ground. And the cricket's on in front of you, and the people are actually there to ensure that the support is what we want it to be.
Yeah, well, hats off to you, because in terms of best practices around the world for these active supporter groups, I mean, you guys would have to be right up there, because you're certainly active, and very rarely is there any trouble that follows you. In fact, you're pretty widely, as much as the Aussies, as much as we like to have a chuckle and a snigger, we also respect the fact that the Army's there and you're there, win, lose or draw. I mean, how did the boys cope and girls cope with the current series?
With great difficulty. I mean, somebody asked me this yesterday. I had a fantastic time while I was at the cricket. You know, I mean, I was lucky. Obviously, I had a lot of friends come over from the UK for it. So for me, it was a reunion. But, you know, we've all become very, very close over lots of touring, so, and we've all seen pretty calamitous tours before, so it's nothing we hadn't seen before. So, you know, I did keep tweeting just when you thought it couldn't get any worse, and then next week I could tweet that again, and then the next week I could tweet it again.
Mate, can you tell us what's the difference? What's been the difference from an English supporter's perspective between what happened in the UK and what's happened in Australia?
Look, I think anybody who can honestly answer that question should be a sports psychologist or sport coach. I think it's a combination of things. Sports are very, very fickle beasts. So I think, you know, form, momentum, attitude. I think, you know, there's sort of often an attitude of, you know, when you've been beaten up for a while, then you come back stronger. And I think 2005 proved that from an England point of view, where we came really, really hard at Australia. And then, you know, it was sometimes as well, you just have those periods where what can go wrong does go wrong. And, you know, from Test 1, you know, Johnny Chott going home, Graham Swan going home, Matt Pryor's form, you know, I mean, I was in Auckland watching Matt Pryor hit one of the best hundreds I've ever seen to save a Test match in March. You know, it wasn't even a year ago. And, you know, everybody was raving about him. And he was just immaculate. He was as good a wicketkeeper as I've ever seen play for England. And then, you know, his form fell off a cliff, and all of a sudden, you know, from Ali Cook's point of view, he's used to looking to his right and having Swanee, and to his left and having Matt Pryor, and instead he's looking at sort of Ian Bell and Johnny Bairstow there, sort of going, well, his leadership group had gone as well. But, you know, fundamentally, I don't think the bowlers did that bad, but just batting-wise, to have your top six just, you know, just no form whatsoever, you know, no hundreds, no nothing, and you just think, you know, all of these guys are, you know, world-class players. You know, nobody's going to say that Ali Cook isn't a world-class bat. Ian Bell is, and KP is, and obviously Trott before he went home. So, but for none of them to perform, you know, it was just, you know, it's sort of just weird, really. You'd look at it and go, surely one of those players would come through. But it just didn't happen. So I don't think they're as bad as losing 5-0. So hopefully they'll just go away and have a break from cricket and come back a bit stronger in the English summer.
Yeah, I think the other player that you didn't mention there was the Duke Ball and not coming on the tour. I think that that helps Australia a little bit from time to time too. While Joe was just asking that question, just to dig the knives in a little bit, I was kind of reflecting on what you were saying about how you know managing the behaviours of large groups of people, and really it's kind of the what is I guess the way we train it in theory. Like you clearly define the behaviours that you want, but then you're constantly monitoring and managing those behaviours, which isn't always easy. And you did mention that sometimes it's as easy as just a tap on the shoulder or a quiet word in the crowd, which is actually the same at club level, really, but quite challenging. With the bowls hat on, do you see many of those cultural issues in the bowls? It's an interesting demographic. There's very old players and seems to be very young players with lots of gap between the two.
It's very difficult. I mean, we got a lot of a lot of comments at state level. You know, that can be as worried as what are you going to do about behaviour on the green?
Yeah.
And you know, the question really should be, well, what are clubs going to do about behaviour on the greens? Because ultimately, you know, clubs should be responsible for the behaviour of their own bowlers, and they should be, you know, they can manage that on a one-on-one basis. You know, we sit in our office, we can't see what's going on out there all the time, unless we're actually at tournament. So, you know, you do want to sort of put that club level, but having that sort of code of behaviour, you know, you would want clubs to have a code of behaviour that they say, no, hang on a minute, this is what we want to do, and clubs generally do have that. But it is difficult. You know, we do get some people, especially cross-generational, and certainly there's a massive similarity here. We'll have people, mainly of the older generation, will come up and give us a massive serve, as the Australians would say, about the noise that we make at cricket grounds. I had a guy in New Zealand several years ago going, you know, you guys are a disgrace, and cricket should be played in deathly quiet. And, you know, you probably get the same sort of thing at bowls, really, where you've got sort of the older generation want a more sedate game, and then you've got the younger generation who are bringing a bit of sort of feistiness into the sport at sort of Premier, sort of Metro Premier Division. You know, you do get a lot of sort of banter on the green, and, you know, I don't know how bad it gets. I don't think it's as bad as Michael Clarke's little jibes to Jimmy Anderson. But, like I said, it's up to clubs to really sort of manage that and just, you know, good behaviour is good behaviour. You're not always going to agree on exactly what should happen, but I'd say it is an issue, certainly. But it's one that clubs should really, really face up to at the first level. Well, actually, firstly, it should be individual people, but I'd say ultimately they're a member of the club first and of Bowls Victoria second.
Paul, Joe here. The sporting landscape is starting to get very, very crowded now with a lot of sports experiencing exponential growth, especially at the grassroots level. Now, bowls has had some spectacular success over the last decade with the more social aspect of the game, Friday night bowls, that kind of thing. What do you see as the major challenge for the sport going ahead?
Challenge I think we've got is all of those people who go into a bowls club and play, whether they're on you know, a social night out, whether they're doing corporate bowls, is to sort of engage those people, to stay in contact with those people, and actually sort of bring them into the game so that they don't just turn up once a year, play a game and go, hey, I really enjoyed that, but then, you know, never go back again. But also it's filling in the gap between that social bowls and also pennant bowls, because when people are time poor, you know, ultimately they probably can't commit, or not many people can commit to playing every Saturday or every Tuesday for a long season. Mm. So finding those sort of middle grounds so that people can get into the game, sort of join the club maybe, and yeah, they might visit, you know, four times the first year and then eight times the second year. But just sort of building that bridge between social bowls and competitive bowls. Because it's obvious that the people are there, and you talk to people who have played it and they go, oh, I really, really enjoyed it. But, you know, how do we get them actually involved in the sport? And if we can manage that, then, you know, that will develop eventually into sort of more pennant players and more tournament players.
Yeah. With your experience, I mean, and this is just the dilemma across all sports is how to engage with their members and potential members and people that come into the club, whether it be for a social function or a third-party event or whatever, with your background in communication, I mean, and knowing the clubs have got a real small workforce and often capacity and skill. How would you recommend the clubs? What are the basic tasks that clubs should be considering to connect and build the relationship and that sense of belonging to the club with the various individuals?
I think it's very difficult because clubs have, you know, different skill sets and different mentalities. But, you know, at the very, very basic level, you know, if you have got people coming through your club, you know, try and collect their data. So whether that's, you know, getting them to write down an email address, whether it's trying to doing a business card draw or something like that, but just some way of actually, let's say, keeping in touch with those people that do come through their doors has got to be the most important thing. You know, I mean, maintaining communication with your club members is obviously vitally important. But like I say, it's those people who, you know, who do engage with you, it's when they drop off. And in the same way that, you know, any time nowadays we sign up for special offers, we sign up for competitions, you know, we go into a store, anywhere we write down our email address, somebody will get back to you and say, hey, you know, you did this, would you like to get more involved? That's something we'd like to see bowls clubs do more and more. But, you know, we're talking generational change, we're talking mentality change. You know, you're talking about, well, who are the volunteers in a club, who are running a club? Is it the older generation because they've got time? Do they necessarily know the importance of that or how to actually do that? So, like I say, is that just, it has to be a very, very basic level, I think. Don't overcomplicate it, but just, like I say, getting clubs to maintain contact with not just the people who come through their club, but the sort of wider, you know, the sports clubs that are around them and developing relationships with them. You know, it doesn't all have to be about Twitter and Facebook, but it does have to be about just saying what you're up to and maintaining relationships with those people who you come into contact with.
Yeah, you mentioned email newsletter or email addresses, so that kind of implies an email newsletter. Do you see an email newsletter as being important for a club or not so important in this day of social media and Facebook and Twitter?
No, I still think, you know, it depends on the size of your club and what it is you want the email newsletter for. But, I think any way of communicating has to be a good way of communicating. Yeah. You know, I sometimes joke about my job at Bowls Victoria is, well, we have to send, if we've got a bit of information, we send it out as a tweet and then send it out via a carrier pigeon and everywhere in between. So I don't think you can over-communicate with people. Yeah. Well, you probably could if you were sending out an email newsletter every day for however long, then yeah, you'd probably be overdoing it a little bit. But like I say, I don't think you can afford to turn your nose up at any way of communicating. We, you know, our printed magazine is still one of our major communication vehicles, even in the sort of 21st century. So they all have their role to play. And especially, I think people need to probably tailor it compared to their actual membership. But email newsletters have to be a good way. Even if you've only got 10 of your members on email, then at least you know you're communicating with them.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, speaking of communication, and I just guess by way of closing the interview, how can people touch base with you or buy a copy of your book, which I do commend? Tweety Cricket Tragic is a fantastic read of what life is like inside the Barmy Army, or living the dream that us sporting tragics have of, you know, going to every single test match for a 3-year period. For Twitter and Facebook?
I've actually got a website for the book, which is goingbarmy.com.au. So that's got some more details on the book and an email link to me. I'm on Twitter at Winslow Journo as well. So you can hear my nonsensical thoughts on all sorts of things on there.
All right, Paul Winslow, thank you so much for your time here on Sports Community Radio. Your insights have been fantastic. I'm sure there's a lot of those that we can take down to our local clubs and communities. And once again, thanks for your time, mate.
No worries. Thanks for having me on.
That brings us to the end of our show, our first show here on 3RPFM, the voice of the peninsula. A very big thank you to all of you out there who have listened to us and for your support. We invite you to listen in again next week on Saturday when we're on air from 7 a.m. And in the meantime, we hope that you become part of our community, our sports community, and contact us for any of your opinions and feedback. We very much welcome that at jointheshow@sportscommunity.com.au. On behalf of Steve Pallas and Joe Novella, thanks very much for joining us.